Paige, the host of Every Child's Champion podcast, and I'm coming to you from my home, recording this in my home this time because of the quarantine situation. I hope you are at home and safe and all tucked in with your children, if you have children, and staying out of the germ zone. Our topic today is trauma. Understanding how trauma and chronic stress impacts preschoolers and how we can reduce the impact of stress and trauma on our little ones when they come back to us in the fall. So you ready? It's a heavy topic, but it's a needed topic. So I hope you stay with me. Let's get going. Okay, back to our topic. Trauma. Oh, yes. Just an aside, since I am at home today recording this, you're probably going to hear some background noises in my podcast today, and I apologize in advance. I have two dogs in my house, and I have a daughter who's on her own now, but she's spending a couple months with us during this COVID-19 thing because she is a teacher and she lives by herself, so we didn't want her to be sheltering in place all alone. So she came home with her very loud and boisterous puppy, Otis. And Otis is a 10-month-old Basset Hound. Basset Hounds are quite loud, I can tell you. And he is quite active. So I'm trying my best to keep everybody quiet in the background today, but you may hear some things from time to time when puppy dogs happen to make their way into the same room that I'm in. I'm trying my best to prevent that from happening. Just want to give you a heads up.
Okay.
So we're talking about trauma today, and actually this topic is very interesting because we're all experiencing a certain amount of stress going through this pandemic that we haven't had to experience before. This is quite new, right? And I can only speak for myself, but I know when it first started around mid-March, it was extremely stressful. My own experience was that I was extremely stressed out, primarily because I'm an independent consultant and I make my living by doing work with schools and programs. And I had quite a few jobs that were set, that were either beginning or about to begin right when this all happened. And of course, most of my work takes place in schools. And, you know, everything came to a screeching halt, except for the rent and the bills, right? And so it was a financial stress that I was under. And I'm imagining that most of you experience the same thing. And for me, it's looking back, it's interesting. At the time, it was not interesting at all. It was sleepless nights and nervousness and anxiety going through the actual logistics of getting my daughter up here from Texas. She lives in Texas and we live in Chicago area. And, you know, getting her up here with her dog and her cat and, you know, getting her in our house and just adjusting to staying at home all the time. But the financial stress was extreme. And that was just totally to do with my business, making sure my business was going to stay afloat. So, but I also am quite privileged in that my husband didn't lose his job, and we had food. We had lots of food in the cupboards. So, when I think about my own privileged life and how much stress I went through, and then I think about the families that we serve, and these young moms and dads who may be in their early 20s, many of them, who are trying to hold the pieces together, and suddenly they have no job to go to. Suddenly they have all their children at home at various ages. Many of them may be single parents. And so the stress of being home day after day and hearing all this news about people getting sick and the fear, These are the ones I worry about. I worry about the parents, and then I worry about the children and the stress and the toll this is taking on them. So that's what we want to talk about today, the stress and the trauma. Of course, I wanted to cover this topic because this is a situation all over the country where not only children but adults are going through a certain amount of trauma right now. Anytime there's a crisis, got the potential for experiencing things as trauma. And one thing we now know about trauma is that when children experience trauma, it can have lifelong impacts. You know, there's really not any easy way to talk about this in terms of ourselves as adults and what we understand about trauma, other than to say any of us who have had any experience with trauma in our lifetime, especially as a young child, knows that it stays with you, that it's not something you just move on from. As a young child, if you experience a traumatic event or a series of traumatic events, such as violence, abuse, death in the family, domestic violence, did I mention divorce? You know, depending on the age and depending upon how the adults around you handle it and help you handle it, it can have lifelong effects psychologically and mentally and emotionally. And so what we want to do, I think, as early childhood experts and professionals is we want to help the adults in children's lives to understand the impacts that it has on children so that they can take steps to minimize children's trauma. And then we also want to come into our job situations, whether we're classroom teachers or directors or, you know, whatever your role is in the school or childcare classroom or Head Start program, you need to have a good amount of understanding of trauma and its impacts on young children. The young children that we're working with that have the most significant behavior problems, unless there is a diagnosable genetic or developmental disability of some type, are most likely dealing currently with the effects of trauma, or in the very least, they are trying to cope with the impact of chronic stress overload that their little systems are exposed to. And so today I thought we would take a look at that, of where those behaviors come from and what the relationship with trauma and toxic stress is to the challenging behaviors that you're seeing in the classroom, and talk about how to prepare yourself for going back into the classroom after COVID-19, after this quarantine, because we're not sure what to expect, right? We're not sure how each individual child is experiencing this quarantine. But on the news, you hear things like rates of abuse have gone up, rates of domestic violence, things like that. And so we can imagine that children are not shielded from this as a source of trauma. When they come back in the fall, the children who have really experienced some of these adverse experiences that don't even have to be outright abuse, they could just be neglect, or they could be in the presence of chaotic home situations and existing in chaos, there's a lot more stress in the families. But these children, when they come back, are going to have an adjustment to make, right? And additionally, something to think about is that all this time they're spending at home with siblings and parents and grandparents, whoever is in the home, they are not developing the social skills, let alone the cognitive capacities and skills that they would be if they were in school with us for these 3 months. So we can expect that there's going to have been some regression. And when you couple the lack of experience or the lack of opportunity for that development to happen, you couple that with higher amounts of trauma and higher amounts of stress, I can guarantee you we're going to be looking at many more challenging behaviors. So let's talk for a few minutes about what the real impact is on kids, how this happens, that's trauma and stress becomes behavior problem. It starts with a basic understanding of brain development. Every emotion, every feeling, sensory feeling that a child has, every behavior is processed by the brain. And the development and the condition of a child's brain will directly impact how they behave, right? Whatever development occurs in the brain is going to determine what it is they can do, as well as what they cannot do. And so we have these things called executive function and self-regulation skills. And these are really important capabilities or skills that are developed with lots of practice and experience over time. Examples of executive functioning skills include things like impulse control, being able to pay attention and focus, being able to follow directions, remember what the teacher asked you to do, having persistence with a task and not getting too frustrated too quickly when you can't do something, and the delay of gratification. So those are examples of skills and capacities that develop over a widespread of time, a few years, primarily, extensively in the preschool years, children are developing those skills. We know that toddlers do not have those skills, right? I've got a 2.5-year-old granddaughter. She's almost 3 now, and she's making progress, but as a toddler, she only can handle a certain amount of frustration before she's going to have a meltdown, or a certain amount of waiting, for example. When they want something, they want it now, they can't delay gratification as a toddler. But over the period of 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age, children get more and more experience with that, and they get better and better at regulating their own bodies and their own minds and being able to cope with those kinds of demands that we put on them. And so that happens because of brain development. You probably know that brain development begins even before birth. A rapid brain development is happening in the infancy. And literally, they're born with billions and billions of neurons that are all over the place in the brain. And during the prenatal months, the neurons are gathering into clusters to create different parts of the brain. And they're getting connected where they're supposed to be. They're sort of migrating to where they're supposed to be. But even after birth, there's a lot more connections that need to happen. And if you think about how a child learns, for example, to talk, they have to hear a word over and over and over again for months and months and months before they ever can produce that word in speech themselves. So the speech center of the brain is very much in development during that first few years. You know, do you want your bottle? Are you hungry? Do you need your bottle? And it only becomes clear that they know that word, that they recognize what a bottle is, when they're about, you know, between 6-7 months, and they start looking at the object that we're talking about, or they start pointing to it. So it takes several months, and language takes the whole first year of experience just to hear the words. It's not until kids are a year old, usually, that they start really forming the words themselves. But anyway, the neurons in the brain are starting to connect with each other, with experience. So the more time a child hears a particular word, the stronger the connection gets in the speech centers of the brain. They're rapidly connecting through synapses, and synapses are the connections. So neurons that fire together wire together, they say. That's a saying, you know. If you pair the image of a bottle with the sound bottle enough times, there's going to be a pathway, a neural pathway laid down to where there's understanding of what a bottle is and there's understanding of what that word is. And so those images and sounds have fired together in the brain through the sensory modalities of hearing and vision enough times that there's been connections that have strengthened and strengthened and strengthened. So these interactions are happening as babies interact with the world, and little kids are in this prime period of brain development. There's complex certain circuits that are being built in their brains throughout childhood. And those connections make the core capacities of the executive functions that I mentioned, make those possible. So the more children use those connections, the more they get experience with those connections, the stronger and the faster they become. So if you think about it, some of the things I mentioned were impulse control, paying attention. You know, my granddaughter or any little kid that's a toddler, they might have an impulse to hit. You know, they might have an impulse when they're playing. Let's say they're bouncing on your lap as a baby and they're playing and they're getting really excited. They might have an impulse to just hit you, you know, in the face, or hit another child, hit another baby in the face. It's an impulse. It's not something that they really understand or are thinking about. They're just doing it. And so we all have certain impulses like that that we're born with. But being able to control those takes practice. And so the first time it happens, the mom or dad that's holding them says, "Oh, no, we don't hit. We don't hit. Be nice. Be nice." And then it might happen again, and they have to experience that again, you know. And so little by little over time, they learn that they need to control that impulse. And again, that doesn't happen overnight. And so it's a matter of frequent and constant experience. It's a matter of practice, having practice with that. And practice like that doesn't happen unless kids are in contact with each other. So social skills and social situations give kids the opportunity to practice those skills. So children who are not in preschool are not getting those opportunities if they don't have peers the same age or peers that are close in the same age. I'm sorry, if they don't have siblings that are the same age. So in a normal situation, when kids come to preschool, they are practicing those skills by playing. They're practicing those skills by learning to take turns, right? As they play games and as they engage in the activities of the classroom, they have to wait their turn. They have to delay their own gratification. They have to pay attention to the teacher during story time. And the teacher every day says, "It's my turn to talk and it's your turn to listen." And children are gradually, they don't come to us able to stop talking, right? As three-year-olds, they come to us and they want to do all the talking. But sometimes they learn that, okay, the teacher's telling me I have to listen right now and pay attention. It's not my turn to talk. And that's not easy at first, but it's with practice. And so all of those executive function skills I mentioned really happen and develop through practice, and the brain, the actual architecture of the brain, the actual synapses and neuron pathways that are being created, those are all happening at the same time through that experience. So it's experience that shapes the brain. And the brain development literally cannot happen without that type of experience. The experience is based on frequent interactions with other people and frequent interactions with the environment. That is why children in, you know, the orphanages in Romania did not thrive, because they literally did not get those experiences. They didn't have those experiences. They were left in cribs, and we saw the damage that caused. So ultimately, they think that the executive functioning skills are part of the prefrontal cortex of the brain, where the circuits there are rapidly connecting to other parts of the brain. But there are also these automatic responses that all of us are born with. And these are like reflexes or survival strategies that we're all born with. And these are responses that are, you know, sort of hardwired into our brains, where if we are in danger, if we are at risk, or if threatened, you know, we have certain autonomic responses that are guaranteed to be there. So we might fight, we might run away, or we might freeze. Those are just in nature, biologically laid down within our brains. Everybody has those. So the fight response, the flight response, and the freeze response. And so everyone has those responses. If the stress or the threat is too high, or if it's a constant threat or a constant stress, these automatic circuits they are the ones that get stronger. And they get stronger or faster. The response time is faster the more the child is threatened. And so if you have that going on, where those automatic responses are called up frequently, you end up with a brain that's a very young brain, 2, 3, 4 years old, that has not had enough experience with the executive functioning development, or the good type of development, and they've had more experience with threats and stresses. So those automatic responses have happened so frequently that they've become patterned into the brain, or laid down as strong connections. And those automatic responses will override the other responses, the learned responses, every time. So in other words, I might be very good at, reading or working on something, doing math problems, whatever it is. But if I'm under threat, I'm at risk, I'm feeling threatened, those skills go out the window, and all my body and mind focuses on is survival. So the automatic responses will always override the learned skills. And the reason this is so important to realize is that that's what we're dealing with when we get kids coming into our classrooms who have been traumatized or have had chronic stress, toxic stress in their lives. Their systems are primed and built. They're literally changed. Their brains are literally changed to where the automatic responses of fight, flight, or freeze, those automatic responses are more hardwired than the impulse control and other executive functions that we're supposed to be developing. And keep in mind that at the age of 3 and 4, they're supposed to be developing. They're not developed. They're in the process of being developed. So those executive functions they have an opportunity at that time to take center stage and to really get firmed up. But if the kid is experiencing trauma or stress at home or out in life, that's going to interfere with the executive functioning development. And other kinds of brain development, for that matter. Scientists even know now that toxic stress, which is the culmination of toxic stress, is just another way of saying situations where the child is stressed so much that they are constantly responding with these automatic responses of fight or flight. They're constantly in high alert state. In other words, their autonomic nervous system never really gets time to calm down to where learning can take place in other veins, in other ways. So the automatic responses are on high drive, so to speak, and that interferes literally with children's thought processes. It interferes with their memory, and it can even interfere with their sensory and motor functioning. I mentioned toxic stress can cause the development of these executive functioning skills to be seriously delayed or impaired. And so brain architecture is literally disrupted when there's conditions of neglect, abuse, violence, et cetera, et cetera. And researchers now call these ACEs, A-C-E-S, adverse childhood experiences. Any human, whether they're living in poverty or not, any human can experience adverse childhood experiences. And now they have tests or questionnaires that they can give to people to determine how many ACEs they've had, how many adverse childhood experiences have they had. They have a version for children and a version for adults that they ask. And it's important to consider how many of these key experiences have happened to a child, because the more the automatic responses, the fight or flight or freeze, the more those are activated, the more the child gets into a constant state of activation of their autonomic nervous system. And what happens when that autonomic nervous system is constantly activated, and I talked about this in another podcast, but what happens when that's activated is you get kids who have attention problems, They might have hyperactivity problems. You get the kinds of behaviors that drive teachers crazy. Inattention, hyperactivity, not following directions, aggression. All of those things have a brain basis. And the brain basis is literally like a roadmap for children. In other words, it's something that they really don't have that much control over once these pathways are laid down. So some of the basic behaviors that are part of the executive functions, that the executive basic executive functions involve working memory, inhibitory control, which is the ability to filter out thoughts and impulses so that we can resist temptations or we can not be distracted. We can learn how to think before we act. This requires being able to focus, pay attention, and control yourself, right? And so inhibitory control is a really big category of executive functions. They also involve cognitive and mental flexibility. So the ability to adapt to situations, to not get too frustrated too quickly, to be flexible with your mind, you know, to be able to think up solutions. Those are descriptions of what cognitive or mental flexibility might be. So the basic behaviors that we're talking about that become impaired or become impeded when there's trauma or toxic stress are listening and paying attention, following directions, resisting your impulses, your urges, remaining persistent or on task with things, completing tasks that you are supposed to be doing, following rules, solving problems, organizing information and making sense of things, making plans and following through with your plans, and things like adapting to change. So we mentioned earlier that these skills are developed through lots and lots of practice. And let's just talk about where that practice happens. The primary place and way that those skills develop is through social interactions and social play. So think about what children have to do when they're playing with other children. They have to follow certain rules. In other words, they have to be able to follow the basic rules for how we treat one another. They have to be able to learn how to play cooperatively. And those children who cannot do that, who don't have sufficient executive functioning skills, they're going to be pushed out of play situations, or they're going to cause the whole play situation to fall apart. Toddlers still engage in parallel play to, you know, two-year-olds. But during the pre-K years, children are gradually developing the skills that they need to function cooperative and social play situations. Certainly by the age of six, we expect children to have mastered most of these basic skills. And so this is what we're talking about gets impaired with neglect and abuse and other adverse childhood experiences. So what can we do? The question is, what can we do? What can we do to turn that around, to repair faulty brain circuitry, right? I'm going to play a short video clip, and this is just on YouTube, so it's public domain. But I want to play this for you, see if you can hear this and remember this. I'm betting that you have seen this video. Here we go. I'm going to turn it up as loud as I can and see if you can hear this. So what was going on there, you might ask? So that was a viral YouTube video of a young father sitting on the sofa watching a program, and his little baby, 18-month-old baby son, was sitting next to him. And basically they were having a conversation. It was all in babbling. The baby's end of the conversation was all in babbling. But they were sitting on the sofa. You probably saw this. Just going back and forth, having this total conversation. And that's what we call that's what babies need. That's what children need so much of, in order to develop. They need attention and connection. That was such a wonderful example, such a beautiful example of a father who was connecting with his son. There was this matched affect, you know, they were right in tune with each other, in sync with each other. It was beautiful. I've done some reading and some research on this, and I've found researchers all over the place who are saying the most important variable in rewiring a brain or in stopping the damage from happening is establishing positive, secure relationships that involve tons of positive serve and return type interactions. Those serve and return type interactions apparently are the key to helping a child heal and recover from trauma and begin to rewire the brain in a positive way and develop some of these and sort of neutralize the nervous system, calm the nervous system so that the child can begin to learn the skills that he or she needs in order to get along in the world. Researchers and developmental theorists are telling us that literally this is what is needed in order for children's brains to develop the healthy pathways that are needed for social interactions and social emotional development. And so if you think about the families and the parents that you're working with that may not know or that may be too stressed to have those sorts of positive interactions with their children very frequently. Think about some of your most difficult children that you're working with. What are their experiences like at home with caregivers and with parents and siblings? Are they experiencing these kinds of interactions? That interaction right there that we listened to and that you saw, I hope you saw on the YouTube video. If you didn't see it, by the way, just search on YouTube for father and son conversation. But those types of interactions, in order to relax enough to have fun with your child like that and to go back and forth and really listen to them, you have to have a certain amount of calm. You cannot have chaos and noise and high levels of stress. And so if you can imagine that the brain is dependent, the brain is literally dependent on this type of interaction happening from very early in the child's life and continuing on and for there to be repairs when there are ruptures, you know, when there is yelling or there is crying or there is fighting in the house or anything that's upsetting or traumatic, that there are repairs and that the parent and child can get back in sync. And so many of our families just don't have the luxury of having that much calm in their lives. They don't have the luxury of knowing how to engage in that sort of interaction with children. And they don't have the opportunity to engage in that, because they're so stressed out and just trying to get through life. And so we have a real huge opportunity every day when these children come to us to give them those reciprocal type exchanges. And we have an opportunity in all the work that we do with families, with home visiting and parent education programs and newsletters and just daily talks when the parents pick their children up. We have an opportunity to build the resources in the parents that are needed so that they can give this to their children at home. We have the opportunity to put in place supports and find out what parents need and help them as much as possible to get the resources that they need in order to have a stable life. And truth be told, we may not be able to change home situations very much at times. There are some families and children with whom we don't get a lot of insight. We're not given a lot of opportunities to support them or to help them or even to find out if everything is okay. And so for those children and for all of our children that have these very challenging behaviors, we have to do what we can when we have them during the hours of preschool and childcare. And I mean, you can literally make all of the difference in a child's life. I've been able to talk to some of the actual researchers who have worked on the development of some of the social emotional support models. And the question always comes up, aren't we just putting a Band-Aid on kids? You know, it feels like what we're doing for children sometimes is like trying to fill a black hole that can't be filled, because we give and give and give and give so much, and we know that children are going back home into situations that are extremely unhealthy. But I can assure you, because I've been reassured by experts who have said, no, you can make a huge difference in a child's life, that you can literally turn a child around even if you don't have a highly engaged parent, that during the hours the child is with us in pre-K, we can build strong, we can be building those strong neural pathways that a child needs in order to have resilience and in order to develop executive function skills that are going to be needed for the years to come. Everything you're doing with your curriculum, your social emotional curriculum, is helping to build the self-regulation skills that children need. When we train on the pyramid model and we talk about the tier one supports, the base of the pyramid is those tier one supports. The most basic thing is establishing positive relationships. But it is so hard when you've got a child who's lacking these skills in a group, right? It is so hard when you have a child who's first impulse is to hit or to be aggressive, and their defenses are so high that when you try to help ask them to do anything, they are being defiant. And what I want to say to you, just to hopefully help you be able to deal with that, is that your relationship really matters on a brain level, that the relationship has to come first, because if it doesn't, If the child is not bathed in these warm, reciprocal, serve-and-return interactions where they literally feel at a heart level that they are safe and that they're cared about, if the child's brain is not bathed in all that, which, by the way, includes hormonal, chemical changes to the brain, if they're not receiving that and experiencing that first, their brain is still in a chemical state of high cortisol, high stress levels. And these neural pathways that have been formed out of fear responses and survival instincts are still going to be functioning. It's only the positive endorphins, the positive sensory experience and emotional experience at a heart level, at a I care about you and you're safe level, that allows the child to come out of that and sort of neutralizes or grounds them in a place where they can begin to respond to real teaching and learning opportunities. So don't give up on the child. Continue to be depositing all of those positives and engaging in those warm, reciprocal, patient interactions, despite the fact that the child is still acting out of this fight or flight or freeze response. Most of the time it's a fight response that makes us the most frustrated and upset. But literally, your relationship with the child is the one thing that's needed most of all. And then beyond that, assuming that we have that covered, then we can start focusing in on giving the child the real everyday social interaction in play type experiences that they need in order to develop these executive function skills. And so what we're talking about there, we're talking about giving them specific opportunities to engage in these skills, which means setting up play situations very intentionally, knowing that they are still in progress, still in process, that they don't have these skills yet, but we're going to give them little by little some challenges to where they have to take turns and they have to wait a minute and they have to pay attention and they have to follow simple two-step directions. And then when they show they can do that, we give them a three step direction and so on and so on. They get challenges that are intentionally planned, teacher-guided activities that you plan where you're providing high levels of support to help them be successful, and only gradually do you reduce the amount of support that you provide for them. The kinds of activities that involve taking turns, and these activities are done very intentionally and very explicitly with a child or children who need to develop these skills. Truth be told, all preschoolers need to develop these skills, but certainly there are a few who need way more practice, lots more practice than others. And so the kinds of skills that we're talking about are the kinds of skills that are found in your social emotional curriculums and your pyramid model tier 2 supports. So there are tons and tons of these resources available, and you need to look in your curriculum under social emotional skills, and you'll see lots and lots of activities. You can look up online executive functioning skills and examples. The NCPMI resources are phenomenal for providing supports and giving you the basics on what these skills are. But they're basically, you know, they're related to social interactions, social skills. Executive functioning skills are not all just social. They're also the same exact skills that children need in order to be successful in school. And so by the time they're getting ready to go to kindergarten and first grade, they've really got to have mastered these, because if they can't pay attention, they're not going to do well in school. If they can't focus, if they can't delay gratification, you know, if they can't deal with frustration, if they can't manage their own emotions, if they can't problem solve, all of those skills are necessary in order to be successful as a student. And they're also important to be successful as a community member. And so these are all, you know, pre-academic skills that we're talking about. But in preschool, they're largely being developed within a social context. And so all you have to do is pay close attention to your social-emotional curriculum, your social-emotional benchmarks. And those are the things you should be focusing on after this COVID quarantine situation is over. These are foundational things that you cannot skip over. A lot of programs focus on all these things for the first 2 weeks of school, then they move into quote-unquote academic things. My assertion is you should be focusing on these things until these skills are in place. And so, yes, you can get into academic stuff eventually, but if you still have children who are struggling with these skills, impulse control means not acting aggressively, right? And frustration tolerance means not falling apart and having a tantrum, not hitting somebody just because you didn't get your way. You know, all of these skills, if you're still having problems, you should be focusing on this. You should be focusing on these skills in your planning. And in a great majority of your day should be focused around giving children practice with these skills in a teacher-guided, safe, teacher-supportive way. I mentioned the pyramid model resources. You can find those on NCPMI website. NCPMI, National Center Pyramid Model Innovations. Oh my gosh, there's so many things, and they're putting up new things all the time. You will find visuals for how to help a child learn how to ask a friend to play, how to help a child problem solve with considering all the options that he has, for finding a solution to a problem, how to help a child cooperate, how to help children take turns, how to help children manage transitions. And so all of these resources are available there. And they, of course, they have some very intentional things such as social stories. I highly recommend creating social stories for children around anything, any topic, any issue or subject that they're having difficulty with. So if they're having difficulty with saying goodbye to mom in the morning and departing, you know, you can make a social story for that. If they're having trouble getting off the bus or They're being defiant about not wanting to clean up. They don't want to sit in group time. They don't want to take a nap. All of these things can and should be addressed very head on with a social story and with a lesson and with intentional practice for the child. And so that means teaching explicitly. It means reading a story about it every single day if necessary. It means giving the child practice in a playful situation, doing role play about the skill. It involves empowering the child. So whatever the difficulty the child is having, giving him a role or her a role or a job, giving them an opportunity to be in control and to get a lot of attention and a lot of support and encouragement, and be really special, you know, in accomplishing or achieving this skill. So there's a lot of intentionality that you have to employ, but this is what's needed at this time. This is what's needed whenever there are challenging behaviors and emotional difficulties. Children are going to need a lot of support and patience and scaffolding to be able to engage in some of these basic social skills and executive functioning skills when they come back. So make it your intention to be very patient and very thoughtful about the activities that you plan. And don't expect high levels of social interactions at the beginning of the year. You know, you have to start the year understanding or being prepared for the fact that many of these children have spent a lot of time in front of TVs and iPads and have not done a lot of social interactions. Their parents have been stressed. Their parents have had other children, older children, that they're supposed to be helping with schoolwork. Many of their parents have been laid off and have huge financial worries. And those parents who have retained their jobs, imagine how stressful it is to try to work from home or work an essential job and also parent the children who cannot go to school right now. By the way, there are even social stories about the pandemic. There are social stories that children can look at and read right now with their parents about why can't we go to school? Why do we have to wear masks, face masks? How come we can't go see grandma? Things like that. And am I going to get sick? You know, these are all the types of concerns children can have. And so I highly recommend printing out the social stories about COVID-19 for your students. If at all possible, can you send them home to the parents so that the moms and dads can be having these conversations with their children now, which is going to lessen the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and how confusing and how potentially traumatic it can be for kids. I'm putting the resources for NCPMI and for the executive functioning skills. There's a website called Vroom, V-R-O-O-M. That is, it's actually an app for parents. And I think it's great for parents and for teachers, but it's an app created by the Bezos Foundation. And the Bezos Foundation is funding this program called Mind in the Making. They've created this app called Vroom, which has tons and tons of little suggested activities that parents or teachers can engage in with young children, specifically for development of executive function skills. So if you need help with activities, just put that app on your phone and you'll have a ready source of little activities. Remember, the goal is to give children more and more experiences with social interactions, more and more experiences with play and social dramatic play experiences. So while providing a ton of support to help them practice those skills, practicing the skills of getting along, practicing the skills of taking turns, all of those social skills that come up in play. The last thing we would want would be for children with behavior disturbances to play alone or to be sort of outcast and do a lot of computer time or a lot of teacher one-on-one time. What they really need is the play situations, but they need a lot of support to be able to manage those. That's where that practice happens. And that's when those brain connections will be made. And so without that practice, we're not laying down pathways that are needed for long-term skill development. There's going to be a lot more to talk about as we get closer to the time that the school year begins again. And so we will not, of course, so probably we will come back to these topics again. I would love to hear your questions and thoughts and comments about what your experiences have been during this time. And we have just about run out of time. It's about time to wrap it up today. So I want to thank you for being a listener, and I'd love to hear from you. We have a Facebook group, Every Child's Champion, on Facebook. I love hearing feedback about the podcast and the conversations that we're having. But this is kind of a one-way conversation to some degree, and I don't always get to hear from you. So I really mean that when I say please share comments on the Facebook page. You can go to our website, www.synapseearlylearning.com, post comments there. I put up a blog about once a month, and most recently I had written a blog about how we can support parents of special needs children. And so check that out. That's on the website. But also come to my Facebook page and connect with me there. I would love to have some conversation with you. And if you need anything, just leave a message and I will do my best to help you out. So at that, I'm going to go see what Puppy Otis is up to. Let's keep our fingers crossed that there was no mischief while I was talking on my podcast today. All right, you all have a great week. Please stay close, stay in, stay safe. Give lots of hugs and kisses to your family, and stay well, my friends. Bye-bye.